our life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good times, the fun and the play, while inside is an aching that won't go away. And we wonder why in heaven are we here today. We fight with our children, wives and husbands too. Feelings running clear through, and the pain of it all dulls all that we do, and we wonder how much more we have to suffer through. The daily news tells our story, sad but true. Violence and killing and wars planned anew, of child abuse and battering done by men the world through. And we women wonder why must we be here too. It's hard to watch the pain and strife go on. Lost in the din, but until men's hearts are opened to the love that lies within, there can be no peace on earth, no joyful life
was Janie Reasoner singing Our Life Goes On. That's my song. My guest this evening, artist, writer, and teacher, Max DeShow, is one of the founding mothers of the women's spirituality resurgence and an artist whose paintings revision bold and spirited women, pagan sacraments, and goddesses around the world. She founded the Suppressed Histories Archives in 1970 to research women's history internationally and understand how systems of domination established and perpetuate themselves. Max has photographed some 1,500 slides and created 100 slideshows on female power and heritage transhistorically, including women's power, women shaman, and on global women's history, archaeology, goddess traditions, priestesses. She uncovers the reality of women's lives internationally and across time, asking questions about patriarchy and slavery, conquest and aboriginality, about mother right, female spheres of power, indigenous philosophies of spirit, and the historical chemistry of their repression. Even more important, their role in resisting oppression. For nearly 40 years, she has presented hundreds of slide talks at universities, community centers, bookstores, schools, libraries, prisons, galleries, festivals, and conferences around North America. Her work bridges the gap between academia and grassroots education. It foregrounds indigenous women passed over by standard histories and highlights female spheres of power retained even in patriarchal societies. Max Deschaux's critique of Cynthia Eller's The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory, published in 2000, has been influential in opening up space for consideration of egalitarian matrilineages. The title is Knocking Down Straw Dolls, published in 2000 and republished in Feminist Theology Sage Publications, UK. Her art has appeared in Daughters of the Moon Tarot and books by Judy Grun, Diane Stein, and Martha Shelley, and her own Witch Dream Comex, as well as many feminist, lesbian, and pagan publications over the years, and in the collection edited by Lucia Chiavola Birnbaum, She is Everywhere. And so I welcome you, lover of music, children, and earth, Max Deschaux.
Thank you, Janie.
You're welcome.
You know, it has actually, we've actually topped 40 years now. The Suppressed Histories Archives started
really?
In January of 1970.
Wonderful. Amazing. It's nice to have you back. Yeah, I don't know, I've forgotten how many years ago, but it was
a
while.
Yeah, I don't know either.
The first question I ask my guests is, what part did your own mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today, or how did she influence your process?
Well, my mom, the best gift that I had from my mother is she sat us down and had us draw and paint as an entertainment activity. All the five kids in my family, we would sit around and we would color and we would do watercolors and we'd decorate our Halloween bags, you know, paper bags and stuff with our own designs. And so she really created a space for creativity in the house. This was nothing like official art school or anything like that. It was just what we did. And I thought everybody did that. And I got all my friends to do it too. I just thought that's how you did. And then later I found out, no, people don't do that usually in their houses. And so, you know, that was something that was really, and she turned out two artists. So that was the best gift she gave to me.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. How important. I mean, that's so basically important, really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about your journey, how you got to where you are now, how this all began? What was driving you to move in the direction of restoring the mother and beginning this amazing collection of slides?
Well, in college, they didn't let me study this. They didn't want to have any consideration of, I mean, in those days, women's history was a joke. I'm talking 1969, and, you know, there was no women's studies. And so the professors were, well, you know, men have always dominated women since the dawn of time. And I knew that wasn't right. And so there's a lot of explanations, but that's the short line of what got me going. And, you know, 1969 was a wild year. Everybody was breaking out all over. And so I just said, oh, I'm out of here. I'm going to just do this on my own. I need to find this out. I need to find out information about where women have been free, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just dig up that information on my own because I was not going to get it writing term papers for these guys.
How did you know, though, that history did exist? How did you?
Well, I didn't have it yet. But I just went looking for it.
You instinctively knew.
I felt it. You know, I knew who I was, and I knew the women that I knew around me, and there was nothing about us that, I mean, well, let's put it this way. I grew up in the Midwest. There were all kinds of mechanisms of socialization for females to get us to knuckle under, you know, so that was very real, and that goaded me in my childhood. I mean, I couldn't stand it, but I knew that there was nothing about being female that meant that we had to be subordinated. That there was there were cultural mechanisms that accomplished that, and so you know, it was a complex thing because I wanted to find female spheres of power and look around the world and see where those might exist. I wanted to try and document if there was anything like that. And then also I wanted to come to account for how we got where we are now in this intensely patriarchal world and in this society, which for a lot of people, oh, you know, it's all solved. Supposedly women are equal, but, oh, there are so many economic and social and religious and legal structures, and let's not leave out the cultural enforcement, you know, the mass media that's so driving to the lowest common denominator.
And rape and abuse that happens.
The violence, the massive levels of violence that are epidemic in the dominant cultures.
Yes.
And also just the degradation of the female. I was talking on Facebook with somebody last week, and I was pointing out that, like, I like comics. In the comics section, there are at least four in my local paper, at least four scripts that have families that are all male. There's a man and his animals, or there's a bunch of men living together and no females except the occasional woman that's being met in a bar, you know. And so you have these artificial constructs that are being passed, and of course there's Dennis the Menace, there's all this anti-female energy out there in popular culture. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of people, they just accept it, that's just, you know, no biggie. But what does that do? What does that do to the psyche of girls and women, seeing that crushing in on them all around?
Yeah. Well, you have been dedicated for over 40 years to this journey, and think of all the people you have educated and instructed in this relentless journey to awaken us to our glorious past.
Oh, relentless. Yeah, well, you know, and I should say that, like, you know, so I dropped out of college. I began gathering information on my own, and then in 73, I began working with images. And that's been a really crucial part of my work, because I think we need to show people. We need to show women in particular, you know, because women are so demoralized that because the images we see all the time are so disempowering. But if they can see this very strong imagery, and the further back you go in archaeology, the more of it you see, of women who are embodied and present and whole and solid and strong, then they can imagine themselves in a different way. So I started collecting slides, and now I have like 15,000 some slides, and the digital archives is what I'm doing now. I'm digitizing everything. Mm-hmm. And so I've got, I don't know how many thousands of digital images as well. And so that's been, that just sort of fell into my lap, the way that events passed, that I ended up using that, because what I want to do is to have a kind of a grassroots level of education, so it's not just the specialists in the ivory towers who know the information about what the Malawi female oracles were doing or whatever it is, you know, archaeological finds and all of that, but that this could be something that could be at the fingertips of anybody, you know, that the women on the street could know about that. And, you know, if they're of African heritage, then they can see that contrary to all of the negative stories in the papers about what's happening to African women, that there are these very powerful precedents of authority and honor that exist that are actually some very powerful models. And the same with all the other traditions. There's something wherever you look on the planet, there is something that is hidden about the women of that place that is positive and powerful.
You know, it's amazing to me. I hear things on the radio all the time of people who are learned and who are speaking as experts, and they never, ever suggest that we had a harmonious culture previously. Mm-hmm. It's like it never even existed. And I mean, these are people that really should know better.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
I mean, for some it's not important, but we're also coming up against, there's this very long-standing academic doctrine of male dominance, and it's considered utopian to consider that anything else ever existed. And what they do is, and that's where that article that you spoke of that I wrote called Knocking Down Straw Dolls.
Yes.
What I meant by that is they throw up a straw doll in order called matriarchy in order to knock it down. And so, you know, the term matriarchy, then the whole conversation needs to happen. It's not the opposite of patriarchy. And I just didn't even use the word because I didn't want to get into this whole assumption that people make that, if you didn't have male domination, then you would have female domination because they can't get out of the domination construct in their minds.
Yeah.
You know, societies have to be based on hierarchy. And so what I'm talking about is a whole other paradigm. And so I'm calling it mother right because matrilineage and, you know, matrilocal merit residence, so male lovers and husbands will come to live with the women's family. And that has all kinds of positive consequences for the safety of women in partnerships.
Yes.
You know, they have their kin around them to protect them.
Right.
And also, it's better for the children because the children never lose their home. They stay in the mother line.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a husband walks out, nobody loses their home. Nobody, you know, we don't have homeless women and children because they have a kindred. And so he leaves,
mm-hmm.
you know. So there's all these structural things that aren't even formally, it's not like, oh, okay, women are going to be over men. It's just that in a natural way, since only motherhood can be known for sure, that falls into becoming the basis of social organization.
Right.
And so anyway, this whole conversation about matriarchy versus patriarchy, and in academia, the doctrine was, well, no, you're just totally stigmatized if you even try to say that other systems exist. And of course, anthropologists know that there are matrilineal societies. And this is complicated because some of the matrilineal societies today are patriarchal. But, you know, what I see is a historical process of more and more buildup of domination structures getting embedded in culture. And once they're there, it's hard to get the hooks out, mm-hmm. you know, and so it just grows. And so that's what I think we need to look at, is that actually if you go into what I would call the more advanced societies, which are in the indigenous world, then you still have surviving mother right cultures.
Could you give an example?
Like the Mosuo in Yunnan province of China, and a lot of people in that whole region, they're the most egalitarian that I know of, but there's the Lahu, and there's a lot of other people in that area that have female courtship and all kinds of, like a whole stellium of related customs that are much freer,
really,
much less gender rigidity.
We never think of that happening in China.
Well, it's a corner of China that's aboriginal, and it was only dominated by the Han Chinese in more recent time. You've got the Pueblo cultures in New Mexico and Arizona. You have people in South America like the Wayuu in northern Colombia. There are the Tuareg, which now they've gone through that historical process. Some of them are becoming patrilineal. But in the Sahara, there are examples of cultures like that. And if we go back 500 years from now in Africa, you'll find even a lot more of those cultures. Mm. You can look at the Chewa in southeastern Africa, in Malawi. There are just dotted around the planet. After all that's happened, there are still some societies that have held on to these traditions. And so when this other dispute goes on with archaeologists, about whether or not the, what Maria Gimbutas calls old Europe, whether these could have been matrilineal or egalitarian cultures, the archaeologists act like this is an odd theory of, you know, something that's being imagined as a golden age, which never happened, when there are living societies on the planet which still have aspects of this kind of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point, somebody's going to have to call the game and say, well, look, you know, you have to be able to take into account that these societies do exist and have existed, and so it's not, and stop treating it as if it's ridiculous to consider that this could have been going on in the Neolithic, not just in Europe,
yeah.
but in Southern
yes.
Asia and a lot of other places.
Oh, yes, and all the rock art that's
mm-hmm.
so telling of such a different world where it was harmonious. This is KZYX. You're listening to Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner, and I'm here with my guest, Max Dachau.
Dachau.
I'm sorry. Dachau. Your websites are beautiful, filled with your gorgeous art, and you have online courses and as well as a DVD. First of all, tell us the your websites.
Okay, well, the main website is suppressedhistories.net, and that's suppressed with an ED and histories with an IES. And you can also just Google Max Dachau, it'll probably come up.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a lot of articles. There's some video clips from the Women's Power DVD that you can view online. And also, that's the place where you can go to see my posters on Sacra Vulva and Female Icons, which is basically, both of those are an international view of, in one case, female figurines from ancient times, and the other case, female positive iconography of the vulva as sacred. And I'm coming up with a new poster that'll be out in a couple weeks that's going to be Vulva Stones. It's a continuation on that subject. That is, there's this whole body, I don't even know how to say this, across the planet in ancient times, people would engrave vulvas into rock. And so it would be caves, it would be cliff faces and rock shelters, or sometimes mm-hmm. even boulders. Mm-hmm. And these would be holy places. And these are still living sites, right here in California, as a matter of fact. There are places where there are baby rocks and other kind of rainmaking rocks and things that have vulvas and also scooped out cup shapes out of the rock. And so I want to just have people be able to look at this and see that this is global. And, you know, what does it mean that, you know, it says something about very deep spiritual roots, and it's a different kind of spiritual vision than the dominant religions, because it is sacralizing the idea of the life giver in the form of the female.
Right.
And that is something that's being held as holy, and it's being something that's being enacted ritually. And so we need to know that, and we need to know, because of a lot of the a fair amount of the books that have come out that are feminist in viewpoint, really scant certain parts of the world. And it has to do with the limitations on what's available to some degree, but also, you know, if you dig really deep, there are things to be found. But that's what I've been about, is digging, prospecting in the libraries and trying to pull this stuff out from all the veils and covers that have been laid over it.
Hmm.
You know, because there are gatekeepers. It's not that this stuff is not known, but it is not considered important. It's shunted aside,
mm-hmm.
and we need to recover it.
Well, they wouldn't want us to know about it, for heaven's sakes.
Well, there's a whole politics to that. It's
of course
true.
There is. Of course, it's a huge... I mean, when you think about all of it, it's a huge politics of keeping anything that is reminds us of the sacred feminine just not seen. Anyway, I could go
and
on
demonized.
And
demonized.
It definitely demonized.
Because
yes.
that's one reason it was not seen. In the case, take the vulva iconography as an example. For years, it couldn't be published. It was considered obscene. It was considered
right.
pornographic, and
right.
you know, so it just didn't make it into print, or it would be in very like you know squirreled away corners
mm-hmm.
where the public couldn't see it.
Mm-hmm. I've forgotten her. Dr. Campra. Who spoke about how our dating happens and that we begin suggesting that the, you know, the I shouldn't talk, I can't seem to get it out. But anyway, rather than having number one begin at the birth of Christ, it should be perhaps at the, I think Merlin Stone has this idea of starting when the agricultural... 8,000, yes. And
so we would be now at
8,000.
20,000. Let's see, how's it going?
We'd be at 8,000. We'd be at 8,010.
No, I think what she did is she did 10,000. So we would have passed 10,000 at, you know, when we turned over to 2,000.
Well,
so at 8,000 BCE, and we're at 2,010 BCE.
I see. Okay.
So we will be 10,010.
Right.
That's right. Where we would be.
But
and I like that. It works.
Well, the point of it is that
people don't necessarily know what you mean.
It includes our other history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It gives us a longer view of history that includes a peaceful and magnificent history. So you can see how the planning has gone all the way back.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, people are reconceptualizing all of this. That's what's happening now. And, thinking about other ways of looking at this and other ways of grouping our ideas about the human experience. Because, look at it from this end, too. People who are in what they call foraging cultures, maybe they weren't ever agricultural, like the Northwest Coast. There's a lot of societies that built very advanced cultures, they never did farm, so a lot of this also, there's a whole technological grid that's been laid over this, and I call it, technical calibration theory. I have a whole article about this on my website under Racism, History, and Lies, where it goes from Stone Age, New Stone Age, Bronze Age, Copper Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, and then, into the modern industrial age. And those are considered, those are important changes that happen, but those become, in the minds of 19th and 20th century academics, became measures of cultural attainment. So you'll find people writing things like, the Aztecs never really discovered the wheel, or, they did all these things, but they still didn't have writing, or whatever. They have these framings of things that if it's not like the way it was done in Europe, then it's not important, it doesn't right. count, it wasn't mm-hmm. advanced,
Right, exactly.
And so people, I feel like a lot of what I'm doing is remedial in trying to just kind of like rearrange the pieces on the board. There's a lot of new pieces. We need a whole new board, actually. But, just to kind of expand the view out to, people don't know, for example, that the Maya had a more advanced calculation of the solar calendar than European American civilization did until the mid-20th century. Huh. Their calculation was more accurate till then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all of this stuff. And, other Mexican societies, like in the area of Mexico City, they had one of the cleanest and one of the very largest cities in the world. Now, I'm not holding up urbanization as the be-all and end-all by any means, but it's just to show you the distorted picture that has been painted of what human experience is like.
Yeah, yeah. It's 7:31. You're listening to KZYX, and this is Women's Voices. Could you talk a little more about your DVD?
Oh, sure, yeah. The Women's Power DVD is based on the slideshow I've done the most. I did hundreds of presentations of this because, Women's History Month, and that was the one everybody picked. And so it's an overview through time and space, modern, ancient, all different regions. And it is looking at women in monuments, stone monuments of women. That's how I begin it. Because we never get to see that. It's like all with generals and kings. And it's like, no, there are these ancestral mother stones all over the place. So you've got your clan mothers, female founders, women chieftains. And the clan mothers especially, I think, is important because people tend to push into the famous women school of thought. But I think that the structural social power is really crucial. And that often is a collective power, so it's not necessarily about one famous person, although those exist too, but that you've got in the entire collectivity of females who are determining basic things about the way things go. Like they control the food supply, and they mm-hmm. can veto war.
Mm-hmm.
You have the
mm-hmm.
Council of Matrons in the Haudenosaunee in Ontario and New York.
Right.
So I talk about that. And then I talk about mother tech, which is women builders and potters and weavers, basket makers, and these are all the life-sustaining support system, or the life matrix, you could call it. And then other kinds of providers, the women who are gathering, the farmers and fishers, the women traders, and female elders. I have a whole section on that because that's another important aspect, another one sphere of power for women. but then more specifically into the seers and shamans, the medicine women and priestesses. I've got a little bit on female physicians, and, you know, this is more modern times and all of the barriers that were laid in the past for women to break into those kinds of professions.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about women shamans? I think you said someplace that it is believed that the shamans were first women, and I would think they would be because women were doing everything.
You know, there's a lot of proverbs and oral traditions in different places that name a woman as the first shaman.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chukchi up in Siberia, which is kind of like the homeland of shamanism, had a proverb that said, woman is by nature a shaman.
Yeah.
And so you have, you know, women inside the clans shamanizing naturally as part of, you know, everything they did. But we're coming up here against a whole, this gets us back to the modern ideology. The most prestigious classic on shamanism, written by Mircea Eliade, his theory was that female shamans only came in late in the game, and it was when shamanism had become degraded and was kind of falling down and falling apart.
Hmm.
But his own data the data he's presenting in his book, Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, contradicts this theory, because he's actually talking about, in the male shamans, a lot of them are either gay or trans. They're dressing in female clothing. They're wearing false breasts or discs over their breasts, you know, representing female breasts. They are speaking in female dialect. Chukchi called them soft man beings. And so, you know, the way I see it is that there wasn't necessarily an absolute the way we have in modern times, where, you know, women have been barred from priesthood or whatever religious leadership roles. It was possible for anybody to be a shaman, but there was a preponderance in a lot of societies of women.
Now you're teaching a number of courses online.
Yeah, and in fact, right now I'm teaching a course called Woman Shaman, and that's exactly what we're delving into. This is giving me a chance to pull together all the images and all of the files and everything I've got, and on this about medicine women, ecstatic priestesses. And we're talking about embodied prayer. I mean, that's really how I'm defining shaman, because in English we don't have a word for this. You know, the ecstatic, going beyond what you could call unified consciousness, where, you know, mind and soul and spirit and body are all aligned, and you go deep. And when you go deep like that and you touch the very essence of being, that is when you know. You can prophecy. That's how you know how to cure. That's where you access that basic vitality that allows you to infuse with life force and do healings.
Mm.
And so that's really important. And so that would take in incantation. It would be sacred dance. It would be drumming. And there's a lot of areas that we're looking into with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be doing webinars on this at some point, but right now it's just in the course. So it's a subscription course, and you can go to my other website, which is www.sourcememory.net, and you can see a little video about the subject, and then it's also a place where people who are interested can subscribe.
Mm-hmm.
Month by month, you can join anytime.
Now, what's a webinar?
Webinar is a webcast. So how that works is you see my desktop and you hear me while I give a talk. And you can also either type or say, you know, you can talk. If you're muted, because if everybody's unmuted, you get too much feedback. But, you know, you can raise your hand and then you get to talk, or else you can type in your comments and questions. So it's possible to have a real-time exchange. And then it's like being at a slideshow, only you're getting it through your computer.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah.
And wonderful. And then you have another course, Spiritual Heritages of Ancient Europe?
Yes, this was the last year, was 2009 to 2010, and I'm going to resume that one probably in next year. I'm just doing the one course at a time. That's enough. Believe me.
I'm sure it is. What is this about?
Well, that goes to to the book that I have sitting in my file drawer. And it is, my book is The Secret History of the Witches. And what I'm trying to do there is to track what happened in Europe. So part of it is about the witch hunts, the Inquisition, the burnings, and also the colonial ideologies that were forged in that process in Europe. But going back much further than that, to look to the spiritual heritages of the priestesses and women shamans in Europe, what were the sacred traditions and philosophies that existed in pagan Europe, and particularly the goddess veneration of Europe, and the healers and the diviners and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
What time frame would this be?
Well, the course I taught last year, we started with the Megalithic era, which would have been starting about 6,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And then going forward in time. So we didn't make it that far forward in time. We did Megalithic Europe, and we did the ancient Greeks, and then we did ancient Iberia, which was so rich. Spain and Portugal, I found all this new amazing stuff from there, because that's an area, you know, they teach us Greece and Rome, and they don't teach us Spain or Finland or, you know, I mean, I'm even talking just in Europe, Lithuania, Bosnia, you don't learn about those places.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very rich. So that's as far as we got, was through Spain and Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll go back and do the Celtic and the Slavic, and I need to go into Italy and talk about what happened in the Roman period, because that had so much formative potency that really shaped the domination structures we're still living with now, mm-hmm. including the all-male priesthood of the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and so on,
mm-hmm.
and but witch hunts as well. The idea of burning at the stake is something that the Romans were doing in late antiquity.
Yeah.
And, of course, the heretics were being burned at the stake, but it was also being done to magicians and for witchcraft. And so there's a whole tracking of how did that all come about,
mm-hmm.
that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Because European-descended societies have never really looked back.
They certainly haven't.
And especially to say what happened to women, you know.
It's not even discussed.
No, and so it's just taken as a given that, well, yeah, you know, in the Greek society, women had it pretty bad, you know, but, I mean, for people that know a little bit, they know that much, or about the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to have a more, I mean, I really want to look, and I am, at the ethnic traditions in Europe, and that includes the spiritual, you know, the religions, the ethnic religions of Europe before Roman times and before Christian times and before feudal times. And, you know, you could call it tribal Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also to see, you know, what were all these evolutions, and how does all of this wind in together, the domination of women, the forced conversion of the Czechs and the Saxons and the various peoples, the Scandinavian peoples and the Britons and everything, how does that tie in together with the feudal system and with the authoritarian structures of rulership and the economics of it all and the peasant revolts. I mean, there's all this stuff is related. But also when you come up to the period of the mass witch hunts, that is where you start to see how the ideologies that were being enforced in the torture chambers on the bodies of these captured women who were being accused of witchcraft, they were being forced to parrot the ideologies of the demonologists, the theologians. And the theologians had come up with not only woman-hating, and woman-hating is basic to it,
yeah.
but it was also deeply racialized. And so you've got black devils carrying off the witches and raping them and having painful sex with them. And so this has so many ramifications for the colonial ideologies that Europe had already become infused with before Columbus ever even set sail.
Hmm.
You know, that these ideas were percolating through the culture by means of the witch burning.
Yeah. You know, I think we have a telephone call.
All right.
Okay. Hello there. You're on the air.
Hi, Janie. Hi, Max. This is Frida.
Hi, Frida.
Hey, Max. So wonderful to hear your voice again. And I want to tell you that the phrase you used of embodied prayer is just so, it touched me so deeply. deeply because I believe that it's something that's been so lost culturally.
Yes.
And I wanted to just mention two books that have helped me sort of come more in touch with embodied prayer for myself. And they're two really wonderful books. One is Tending the Wild by M. Kat Anderson. And she has done an incredible study of Native peoples in California and how California was tended formed by the indigenous people.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And it's just it's such a humbling experience for me to read this because it challenged many assumptions that I had about the place that I live in and why this place is how it is. Mm-hmm. And then another book that really does address a lot in concert with what you're talking about is a book called My Name is Chellis, and I'm in Recovery from Western Civilization. And the author is Chellis Glendening. G-L-E-N-D-I.
Yeah, I've heard of her. Uh-huh.
N-I-N-I-I-N-G. And she, you know, the embodied prayer idea is not unusual in cultures that haven't been torn away from earth rhythms and shamanism. And
yes.
They're fully, you know, fully integrated people, which I just find a beautiful concept and one that's so lost, and I'm so pleased to hear you talk about it to help us understand that it's possible.
Mm-hmm. It's possible.
Thank
and you.
You
know, one of the things we looked at in the course is a video of Essie Parrish, who's a Pomo dreamer.
Excuse me. Caller, would you mind hanging up? There's a lot of static
sure.
on your line.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, the Pomo dreamer, Essie Parrish, was real, you know, just the living example of what that can be, that embodied prayer.
I think we have another call. Can
dancing
you hang
dancing and chanting.
Oh, no,
yeah.
There we go. Oh, we do. Okay, hang on. Good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Hi.
Could you turn down your radio, please?
Sure, thank you.
Can hear that little echo.
Yeah, anyway, she dances and chanted, and it's so sacred what she does, singing the doctoring songs in the roundhouse over there at Stewart's Point in Northern California.
Oh, lovely. Yes, hello, caller.
Yeah, hi. I think I was always wondering, like, how patriarchy got started. And, and my theory was that the goddess societies were too merciful, and they merely banished all these rotten apples who were, I think, either sociopathic and violent men. And over the centuries, these guys found each other and grouped together and began raiding and enslaving women and forcing, you know, women to give birth and to make more of themselves. And from there, they just kept on expanding, just like a virus ruining the earth.
Well, the virus aspect is definitely that's definitely active. There's a lot of ways. I mean, I don't think there was ever one way that it happened because there are all these complexities in some societies that arose from within.
Excuse
in
me,
other
what?
Societies, it seems to have come at least partly from invasion from outside.
Excuse me,
yeah.
One moment. Do you have your radio still on, Elaine?
I'm let me turn it down some more.
Oh, turn it off. Yeah, I'm getting a echo.
Yeah, that's a very complex.
Well, it wasn't invasion problem. By the steppes, but from the steppes, but we don't know how they got.
Okay, but
there.
See now that gets you into that. That's like we can't only talk about Europe because if we're talking about how patriarchy began, we have to look in a global. Way.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, at one time, you know, Maria Gambutis found all these relics that all over the world, they had sculptures of the goddess. And at one time, before patriarchy, like a measly 6,000 years ago, everybody was in the goddess society. And so I'm thinking that, you know, just by merely banishing all the rotten apples, that's what caused us to get where we are today.
Oh, gosh. You know, Barbara Mann talks about how the Six Nations of the Iroquois, they would banish rapists, for example,
but it would isolate them. They would have no people, and they would become basically outcasts, but then the people would continue on. So they were the ones that were continuing were the societies themselves. I just think it's very complex. You know, I think that there are a lot of things that happen internally, but one of the dynamics I see going on as you get people fighting with each other over resources, especially, you start to have captives being taken. And what the form of early slavery seems to have been female slavery, where you have women being taken as captives.
Yeah, that's what Sonia Johnson said. Like, there was a quote that when the men first crossed the river, you know, before they started taking captive men, they first enslaved the women. And so I really don't understand the virulence of hatred of women and where that came from and why we've been so universally hated, like, mm-hmm. and all over the globe. It's just getting worse.
Right. Well, and that's really a question about the problem of evil in the world, because that's what we're really talking about. Mm-hmm. But the going back to the captive idea, I mean, part of what we have to look at is that there were women who tolerated their brothers taking captives and bringing them back into the clan, you know, so that there was a division between women. That's something we have to look at. I mean, I think that's really an important part of the problem of patriarchy, is not only what men did, but women going along with injustice to other women.
Yeah, that's the diabolical genius of patriarchy, are all the artificial divisions where there should be unity and artificial unity where there should be division.
And I would extend that, because I think that is a problem, just as we say, you know, the male-female dynamic in patriarchy of dominance, that the same kinds of issues were faced by indigenous peoples, both males and females, who faced conquest by outsiders. Because divide and conquer was also the operative principle that made conquest succeed.
Yeah, and they're still up to it.
Yeah, so you know, I mean, there's a lot of things about, because this all basically boils down to domination, right?
Which Rhian Eisler writes about.
Yeah, that's
a
right.
A great deal. Yeah,
well, I see some good signs too. Like there's today, there are more feminists on Earth than ever, and feminism has gone global. I mean, there's feminists in Afghanistan that's facing all kinds of horrific treatment, and also in other really severe sexist male societies. And so I think that women are just an unstoppable force. I mean, just like the little plants growing up through the cement.
So may it be.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ruth. Bye. Bye-bye. Yes, it's good.
Yeah, we have a lot to contend with, but you know, I think it's I'm feeling like, you know, we're on the cusp of another resurgence here, because in North America there was quite a backlash, and a lot of women kind of fell by the wayside and said, "Oh no, I'm not a feminist." And you know, you get nowhere by doing that, of course.
We've got another call, and then we could talk about the what's happening in the heavens too regarding the changes.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Hi. My name is Motherwood, and I have a question for Max.
Yes.
Max, this is Motherwood, and I'm on your friend.
Oh, yeah, hi.
Paige, hi. So good to hear your voice. I called in because I want to know, what do you believe about the awakening goddesses and this new energy that's coming into the paradigm where women are coming into their powers, where we are remembering the energies that we had before and connecting,
yes,
with ancestral and the new energy that's here.
Yes. I think it is just blown up. It's going on all over. It's really something that is spreading. I see it going on Facebook. I see it in a lot of different places. And I'm hopeful, because I think that part of what this means is that finally we're getting to the point where there's an integral view that spiritual and political are not separate, and that they go together, and that we have to have this reverence for life, for the divine pervading us, that we need that as part of our consciousness, you know, for respect for Earth, for each other, and also for what's happening with women. So the divine female is extremely important, and this is being recognized
and more. Yeah, and for life itself, really.
And for life itself, that is life itself. That's what life itself is. So I'm seeing that happen, and it's like, oh,
goddess. I'm so glad it is bearing fruit now. Because for a long time it was polarized, and people would say, you got to pick one, politics or spiritual. You know, and you can't do that. It goes together.
Yes. What can we do to empower and ensure that this energy becomes more stable and that more are aware and awakening to it and have it accessible? Because with the economy right now, you know, many of us do not have the resources to go to a lot of workshops or online classes.
That's a very important question, because I think that it should not be a $300 fee and having to fly somewhere in order to do this. And I think that what you're saying is true. The necessity that we're in and the extremity that we're facing is going to make us create this locally where we are. And we're going to have incantation and invocation and sacred dance and circles, and it's going to come in, which we've already seen happening, like some of the demonstrations where they have drums, and maybe we'll start carrying banners and, you know, divine images as part of what we're doing to defend, you know, immigration rights and whatever else it is we're fighting, you know, fighting against violence against women, that this will all become integrated together.
It's so
exciting. But we have to do it locally, and it should not be a class-based thing that only if you have money do you get to participate in this or be seen as part of it, because that's just wrong.
Right. That's great. Thank you so much. Your questions have been wonderful. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I really feel that are we going to get a little something? No. I really feel that anything that's happening that does not include and mention the reemergence of the sacred feminine simply isn't going to go anyplace. Otherwise, it's business as usual.
The other thing about what Mother Witt was saying is that, you know, we have all of these ancestral heritages that a lot of people are looking back and saying, okay, where do I stand? What's my authentic place to stand in on this earth? You know, where do I come from? And so there's that aspect. And then there's this whole other unification aspect, which is what they're bringing that, and they're bringing that to the larger circle, and there's all this cross-pollination going on, and there's all this energy that's flowing around and being shared. And so I see that as a very hopeful sign, you know, because we're not going to do it just like our ancestors did, not exactly like that, but, you know, we need to be able to draw strength from that and be inspired from it.
Right.
And yet, you know, we're birthing something new now, and we're doing it in a historical moment that it's so desperately needed.
We're on the edge. We have another phone call. I'll take it, but it has to be really short because we're running out of time. Hi. You'll have to be really short because we're just running out of time. Really quick question.
Okay. I had a question. That book title that she was talking about earlier, the My Name is Shellis and I'm Trying to Get Away from Western Society or something.
Yeah.
I was wondering if I could get that title again. I really want to get it for my friend. It sounds like
My name is Shellis and I am in recovery from Western civilization, I think is what she said.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, it's hopeful, and then we see the horror, you know? It's a mixed bag that we're living in, that's for sure. The worst of times and the best of times.
Mm.
Wouldn't you say?
It's challenging. What can I say? It is. It's exciting, and it is challenging. I mean, you know, we're facing survival issues. I don't think the economy is getting better.
It's
going to go down.
It is going to go down. I understood Social Security. That's very frightening for me, and I'm sure a lot of people, that they're going to take it away little by little. So this is,
I'm rejoicing that an empire is falling, but
yes,
you know, we are all in it, and how is it going to fall on us? You know,
that's
trying to avoid
right.
that.
That's exactly right. It's been wonderful speaking with you, Max, and I look forward to, you're on Facebook, and it's very fun to see you there. And
yeah, there's a Suppressed Histories page on Facebook people can check out.
Oh, good. And all the things that you bring up of new discoveries, archaeological digs that are coming up with new material.
All the time.
All the time.
Really amazing stuff.
And it's all feminine. So, anyway, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Great talking to you.
Yeah, and you too. Good night.
Good night.
Our life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good.
good times, the fun and the play. While inside is an aching that won't go away, and we wonder why in heaven are we here today. We fight with our children, wives and husbands too.